Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality professional development for all GAC-registered optometrists. With case studies and in-depth conversations, each month we explore the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, docket.info. This episode is a follow-up to the excellent Docket webinar on glaucoma, the Optic Disc Challenge. Detecting and diagnosing suspect glaucoma isn't an exact science. It's one of the things that most of us will struggle with at some point. And the stakes are high. If the optic nerve damage isn't detected early enough, it will lead to irreversible vision loss. When we're monitoring patients, some changes that we detect can be subtle or confusing, and that can cause delays for the patient's pathway to treatment. We'll spend some time making sense of all of this so that you can be confident that you're making the right clinical decisions. And later on, optometrist Patrick Gunn will be answering some of your questions following his webinar session. He'll also tell us how to make the most of the equipment that we have at our disposal.
We always have doubts in terms of our own clinical knowledge and skills. It's just to think about some new ways, some new techniques that we can kind of hone in on some of those aspects of optic disc assessment.
But first, to understand how optometrists can play a part in a patient's journey, I spoke to Rajiv Mittal, who attends Paddy's Clinic at the Manchester Royal Eye Hospital.
My name is Rajiv Mittal. I am a consultant pediatrician in Chester. I have got bilateral open-angle glaucoma, normal tension, and I have got bilateral cataracts, which have been operated.
When did you first find out that something was wrong with your eyes?
So I have been going for my normal eye checks every 1 to 2 years. When I went on 5th of March 2018, the optometrist there found some problem in my eye. He didn't tell me what the problem was, but he said there is a problem in your visual fields. He also found early signs of cataract. So he wrote to the GP, asking the GP to make a referral to the hospital. After about 3-4 months, I saw a locum consultant in the hospital. So he picked up that there is a normal pressure glaucoma in both eyes, and there is some thinning of my optic nerve in one quadrant.
So with the information that you were provided with by the consultant at that stage, how worried were you?
I was very worried, actually, because I was not expecting, because I didn't know the importance of visual field defects. So I was just assuming that it will be like a normal appointment. But I was not reassured after that appointment with the consultant.
What happened next?
So the ophthalmologist can see some cataracts in both eyes. So he said whether this is affecting your quality of life. I said, yes, it does interfere in my driving, especially at night. So he just said, okay, you need to start taking these drops and we are going to book you for cataract surgery.
And at what point was your care taken over by a specialist optometrist?
So I was not happy with this consultation. Basically, I didn't start the eye drops because I was not convinced that it is glaucoma. I wanted to see somebody else. So I was seen by a different ophthalmologist in the hospital who confirmed that, yes, I definitely have glaucoma and I need to start taking eye drops. So I started using the eye drops, and thereafter an optometrist started following me. And I also chose, for the continuity of the care, I always used to say whenever I used to go for follow-up that I want to see the same optometrist.
So your glaucoma was being managed at this point by a specialist optometrist, but with a consultant in the background to refer to if necessary.
That's right.
And then you went on to have cataract surgery, is that right?
That's right. After about 1 year or 1.5 years, I had a cataract operation in my right eye. And after that, I had a capsulotomy as well of that eye, which was done by an optometrist.
And at this point, how well was the glaucoma controlled?
So the glaucoma was more or less controlled. So I didn't have any problem with glaucoma.
So that was in 2019, was it?
So the first cataract surgery was in 2019 and the second one was in 2021.
And how has your eye health been since then?
I had posterior capsular opacification in both lenses after surgeries. So I had that laser treatment for both eyes after the cataract surgery. But glaucoma has remained stable, more or less. No major problem with the glaucoma.
And you're taking drops to manage that, are you?
So yeah, I'm taking monopost and beta blocker.
Excellent. So having gone through the system as a patient, what are your own thoughts on how you sort of communicate with patients now? You've had this very personal experience.
So from personal perspective, I think because the glaucoma is a chronic condition, and the way the hospital works, every time it's a different consultant or different registrar. So you don't build that relationship. So I really valued that it is the same person. So I saw an optometrist every time after that. I have built a relationship with him and he knows exactly what to do. He does go to the consultant if needed. He knows when to ask for help. And that I have found very useful because it is always the same person. So he knows what my case is.
Yeah, so the continuity of care is really important in a chronic condition. And you mentioned it was an optometrist, a specialist optometrist. So there are career pathways where optometrists can undertake further qualifications and training in order to take on these roles. So it sounds as if you really benefited from this service.
Definitely, we benefited from this. And in my professional life as well, we are using ADSD nurse specialist to do many of the things which were previously done by the doctors, but now these are being done by the nurses.
I guess it helps to alleviate the burden on the NHS as well, because obviously the doctor's time is already very stretched. So if you can have more help to do some of those examinations, some of those techniques and to co-manage, then it means that we can see more patients in a timely manner.
Yeah, I fully agree. Yeah.
Rajiv, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's a lot to unpick there, but to help me do so is Patrick Gunn. Paddy is the lead optometrist for education and training at the Manchester Royal Eye Hospital, and he's a glaucoma specialist. He also presented Dockett's recent webinar on glaucoma and optic disc assessment. Thanks for joining me, Paddy.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
So can we start by talking about Rajiv's story, which we started the podcast with? You're his optometrist at the Manchester Royal Eye Hospital. So his high street optometrist referred him initially. They didn't actually tell Rajiv what they specifically found or what they thought could be wrong with his eyes.
One of the challenges that we have as optometrists is being able to tailor the communication to the needs of our patients. All of our patients are different and some patients prefer to have more information than others. Optometrists are the primary eye care health expert, and I think that we need to do more to empower optometrists to be able to be more confident to speak to the patients about what we think the diagnosis is, and to be able to support optometrists to feel comfortable in counselling patients appropriately.
Yes, after all, I mean, optometrists want to be able to inform patients but not worry them too much because they don't have all of the data yet. So yes, it's always a case of inform the patient, but be aware that there are further tests that need to be done to confirm or not confirm what you suspect.
Absolutely.
And an additional factor in Rajiv's case is that he also had cataract. In situations like this, when patients have more than one pathology, does this complicate things when it comes to referral, do you think?
I think it doesn't need to complicate things. Sometimes it does. I guess the best advice that I could give when it comes to referring a patient where you identify two pathologies, often cataract and then another pathology, is to make sure that you refer that patient to one provider for all of their care to be done. Sometimes we do find occasions where patients get referred separately for their glaucoma and for their cataract surgery. Those patients will sometimes undergo cataract surgery and actually a different approach to that cataract surgery, for example, combining it with a glaucoma stent or thinking about a very specific approach in a narrow angle patient would have been very, very helpful in terms of the ongoing management, the long-term planning of that patient's glaucoma management. As long as you can explain to the patients the reasons why you'd make a recommendation for them to be seen with all their care under one hat, you know, it's up to patients to make that decision there. So of course, there's always going to be differences and exceptions to that advice. And so it's really just about being able to figure out what's the best thing for that patient. But I think that cataract certainly does cause complications in glaucoma when it comes to management, but also cataract surgery can have huge benefits for glaucoma patients. And so it's just making sure that that also is taking into consideration the management of their glaucoma.
Yes, we need to listen to patients and make sure that they are at the heart of decisions about their care. So communicating the options clearly to them is really important because it helps them make a more informed choice. It was interesting to hear as well that Rajiv actually preferred to see a specialist optometrist for his ongoing management in the hospital. So how did you end up specialising in glaucoma? How did you choose that as your thing?
I guess it's one of those things that came about quite organically. I probably always had a bit of an interest in glaucoma because my granddad had glaucoma. And certainly as an undergraduate, I did some volunteering overseas. And one of the things that upset me about seeing the breadth of pathologies was seeing the irreversible nature of glaucoma and patients at a young age presenting with really advanced glaucoma and thinking this is heartbreaking. This is definitely something that I'd like to contribute towards helping prevent. And then I loved the clinical diagnostic test, optic nerve assessment, gonioscopy, knowing that those patients were with you for life. I really like the fact that you get to build that relationship with patients as well. You get to see those same patients coming back. And I think that that's a really nice thing.
Well, you're definitely selling it to me at the moment. So if other optometrists out there that are thinking, yeah, I really like the sound of that, I think that's something that I want to do in my career now that I've been perhaps qualified for a couple of years, want to do something different, contribute in a different way, what advice would you give them at this stage?
I think just to look for different opportunities that are available, both in terms of developing your clinical skills, but also to get involved in glaucoma services. And there's lots of services available in primary care. There's glaucoma repeat measurements. A lot more areas are starting to commission enhanced referral services and low-risk glaucoma monitoring services. And so I think that speaking to your LOC and finding out what's available and getting involved, sometimes that requires additional qualifications. And certainly I benefited a huge amount from doing my qualifications. I think that that's helpful both in terms of getting involved in different services in primary care, but also in terms of getting hospital experience. I think IP is another really nice way to help empower you to feel a little bit more confident in terms of that clinical knowledge and skills. And so getting that experience through qualifications, particularly if there's not services in your areas or there aren't any obvious openings to be able to get that clinical experience, I think that thinking about qualifications can be a good place to start.
Paddy, thank you. We'll be back with you in just a moment to pick up on your Docket webinar on glaucoma. You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month, we explore the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. So if you have any suggestions that you think your colleagues would benefit from hearing, email us. The address is podcast@docket.info, or you can tweet us at Sound Optometry. Today, I'm joined by Patrick Gunn, the lead optometrist for education and training at the Manchester Royal Eye Hospital. Now, your recent Docket webinar concentrated on optic nerve head assessment. What are the key messages that you want to get across from that session?
I think that the key message was really just to try and encourage optometrists to reflect on aspects of their optic nerve assessment to be able to help them make diagnoses. And for areas where there are doubts, because I think that we always have doubts in terms of our own clinical knowledge and skills, it's just to think about some new ways, some new techniques that we can kind of hone in on some of those aspects of optic disc assessment too. I think that we live in a challenging world as optometrists with new technology. For a lot of people, OCT can be a little bit overwhelming in terms of being able to factor that into their sort of daily clinical life. And so hopefully looking at some cases where OCT can really help you, but also hopefully sets that tone of balance between being able to make the most of all of the different tools that we've got available to help look after our patients and detect glaucoma.
Yes, I think we definitely do have to use as many tools at our disposal as we can and take all of the information, because I think really when we're looking at the optic nerve head, it doesn't help that we're looking through a very tiny hole with very small light.
Absolutely.
So if we could just start by thinking about the risk factors for glaucoma, because a couple of questions did come up and we all know the common risk factors like family history, high myopia, but I think you mentioned migraine and Raynaud's disease. Why are they risk factors?
It's really important to think of other factors like migraine and Raynaud's. Certainly, I wouldn't be asking each and every patient as part of a routine eye examination those questions, because they're going to have very little relevance to the majority of the patients that I see. Any kind of vasospastic conditions or where there's issues to do with blood flow are going to have a real relevance to the optic nerve. So if you think about it, if you've got poor circulation to your hands and feet, you're going to have poor circulation to your optic nerve. And it's that poor perfusion to the optic nerve that can cause that damage and could cause glaucoma to develop and glaucoma to progress. And so it's important to identify those risk factors, particularly when we're looking at making that diagnosis. In terms of relevance in normal day-to-day practice, perhaps if you had a patient that was demonstrating some signs of normal tension glaucoma, perhaps they had a slightly iffy-looking optic nerve, or they'd had a disc hemorrhage and maybe a little something going on with their visual field, it might be useful to chat to patients about some of these additional risk factors, because that might just be enough to tip the balance to think, do you know what, actually, I do think it's worthwhile thinking about referring this patient. So something to consider, but not something that we need to be thinking about all patients, more so a specific question for those patients at risk of glaucoma.
Sticking with the subject of blood, quite a few people did actually ask about disc hemorrhages because you showed an image of a splinter hemorrhage. And I think that set people thinking, you know, when is it relevant? Because we know it's relevant, but why is it relevant and what do we do about it when we see one?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's a question that comes up often. Disc hemorrhages can be caused by lots of reasons, so diabetes, high blood pressure, posterior vitreous detachment, but they can also be a sign of glaucoma. When we get concerned about a disc hemorrhage, or it's going to make us more alert to glaucoma, is if we can see any other signs. So, for example, if at the location of the disc hemorrhage you can see some rim thinning, or if you pop the patient on an OCT and there's an obvious retinal nerve fiber layer defect that extends in that area, then these would definitely be signs that you probably want to refer the patient routinely as a glaucoma suspect. And so I think that it can be a useful sign. In terms of how we factor it into cases where we think about known glaucoma patients, certainly when I first started in glaucoma clinics, if we identified a disc hemorrhage, we used to bring that patient back after 4 months. So we used to bring them back just a little bit sooner because the evidence supported that that could be a sign of progression. I think with time, there's been more evidence that questions how reliable a disc hemorrhage is as a predictor of progression in glaucoma. And so I still do treat those patients with a little bit more caution in terms of how I follow them up. But I wouldn't always fix a follow-up based on a disc hemorrhage. I'd be looking at other factors and other things.
So if an optometrist is thinking, well, maybe it is glaucoma, but I'm not 100% sure, is it worth them sending a concurrent referral to the GP as well for a systemic workup?
It's worthwhile having that conversation with the patient. So, for example, if somebody's got a disc hemorrhage, no other signs of glaucoma, I would speak to the patient and ask them about basic kind of bloods. When was the last time they had their blood pressure and blood sugars checked? If they had it checked a week ago, and say that the blood pressure was quite high and the GP started me on some medications, you think, well, I don't really need to do anything here. If the patient's a GP dodger and they said that they've not had their blood pressure checked in 20 years, then I think that it's on all of us as any health professional to encourage patients to be having those regular routine checks. And so certainly in those circumstances, I'd be definitely encouraging that patient to see their GP. And I think that in circumstances like that, it can be useful to give some guidance for GPs about why you're asking for those particular tests, why that might be relevant for that particular patient.
Just moving on to the optic disc and the clinical assessment of it. We all know the basics of actually looking at CD ratio. So let's sort of skip that and just go on to where it's slightly tricky to tell where the edge of the cup is. What key things can you tell optometrists out there? What are the things that they need to look for? What are the subtle things that they can pick up on to help determine where that edge is?
It's a real challenge for all of us. And I think that sometimes what we have to be honest about is that we can't always identify exactly where the edge of the cup is when you're looking and assessing an optic nerve. And particularly if you are doing a little bit of a sketch, you know, it's perfectly reasonable to draw that slope of where the cup starts and where that edge of the cup finishes, because sometimes it's quite ambiguous right where the edge is. Looking in circumstances where it's quite difficult, you know, tilted or sloping or myopic discs, or where you've got what looks like subtle generalized loss in glaucoma, trying to avoid just focusing too much on pallor and trying to look at the path of the blood vessels can be really, really useful.
And when it comes to identifying changes in the blood vessels at the optic disc, what are your top tips?
If you see signs with a patient that seem a little bit more difficult to interpret or pointing towards glaucoma, is we're just having a bit of a little look following the blood vessels, seeing if you can see any sudden changes in direction, which can be a really nice pointing sign. Well, maybe that's where the edge of the cup is there. I think if you're struggling on your clinical examination, either dilating the patient and having another look, or if you have routine imaging in your practice, go back and have a look at the photographs, see if that kind of helps you in terms of being able to map things to the blood vessels. But the main bit of advice would be to try and navigate from the blood vessels and the neuroretinal rim and try and avoid just looking at the pallor, because I think that that's probably where sometimes we can get those red herrings.
Yeah, there was a few questions about bearing of blood vessels. Can you describe what that is?
Of course, I can. A sparing of a circumlinear blood vessel often occurs in glaucoma, but equally it can occur in normal eyes. And this is where documentation is really important, whether that's documenting in your notes or taking photographs. So the circumlinear, most of the time, but not always, follow the contour of your neuroretinal rim. And when the blood vessel is bared, that means that there's a gap of neuroretinal rim in between the edge of the cup and that circumlinear blood vessel. So you can kind of see an area of pallor in between there. That can be very, very fine, or that can be a larger amount there. And what that can sometimes be a sign of, that you're starting to lose neural tissue in that area between the blood vessel and the cup. And that can be a nice sign to pick up. And so again, I think that if we are working in an environment where we're sketching optic nerves in a glaucoma clinic, or we've got a patient where we're thinking this patient might be a glaucoma suspect, but I'm not thinking about referring them just yet, perhaps I think documenting where those circumlinear blood vessels are and then using that as a way to be able to look for change can be really very helpful.
So I was thinking about the neuroretinal rim. Can you explain what the isn't rule is? Because we talk about it all the time, but I think it might be nice just to get it on record exactly what we should be looking for there.
So I think the main importance of the isn't rule is really focusing your attention on looking at the difference in terms of the rim width inferiorly compared to superiorly, compared to nasally, and compared to temporally. And so in a decent proportion of normal patients, the isn't rule is obeyed, where the inferior is thicker than superior, which in turn is thicker than nasal and then temporal. And then if there's changes to that, historically we were always told that that could be a sign of glaucoma. And in a lot of cases it can be a sign of glaucoma, but often that we find that patients with normalized, the isn't rule doesn't hold. Where I find it most useful is about thinking about making that documentation to how the neuroretinal rim configuration is. And so if you did have a patient where the isn't rule wasn't obeyed, I think that looking to see, well, actually, in the area where it's not obeyed, so for example, if it was thinner inferiorly, are there any suspicious features in that area inferiorly that would indicate glaucoma, or does that look quite typical for this type of patient? And that's a really helpful sign to be able to identify that there's likely some changes, but don't agonize too much if the isn't rule doesn't hold, particularly if there's no other signs of glaucoma.
But if you do have findings from other tests that raise the degree of suspicion, such as an abnormal visual field result, that can make you think, oh, yeah, the two things add up together. And that sort of strengthens my reason for referral. So, staying with visual fields, I think a couple of people were asking questions about the macular 10-2 test, which you mentioned in the webinar. And that's not necessarily a test that I would naturally go to when I think about glaucoma. So, what's the relevance of it in glaucoma?
In quite a lot of patients, particularly patients with normal tension glaucoma, we see early paracentral visual field defects as the first sign of glaucoma. And if we think about visual function, which should always be at the forefront of our mind when we're thinking about our glaucoma patients, these are the patients that we should be most concerned about. If patients are developing central visual field loss, they're far more likely to have an impairment in their vision as a result of their glaucoma. And so in day-to-day practice, a 10-2 visual field wouldn't be something that I would do routinely, although I have more recently been doing it on the odd patient where I do see what looks like very suspicious signs of glaucoma, but they've done a normal 24-2 field. So on the odd occasion that I've done that test and then I've found an early defect, that's been helpful to enable me to make that decision to refer. Or where I've been sitting on the fence and they've done a normal 24-2 and a normal 10-2. Well, I think, well, do you know what? What's the point in referring this patient now? It's unlikely that anything's going to be done in terms of treatment. I'm going to bring them back again in a year's time. We'll repeat the visual fields, we'll repeat the OCT, we'll repeat the clinical examination. And if we're doing all of the tests that would be done in the hospital, why on earth would we refer this patient? And so I think that it can be useful from that perspective. It's all thinking about, well, what's the most appropriate test for this particular patient and not thinking about over-testing or over-imaging our patients when we think that there's not actually the need for it.
Yeah. There were a lot of questions about OCT because it's a technology that's fairly new in our practices. But as one listener put it, a lot of optometrists have had OCT drops in on them, and they don't feel like they've had any real training on how to interpret the glaucoma images.
I think that that's a really important point, and certainly something that resonates, I think, with lots of optometrists. I've got friends who've recently come back from maternity leave to find an OCT in their practice, and suddenly they're expected to be able to make clinical decisions with very little support. I think when it comes to being able to know when to be able to accept an OCT as being a sort of important factor when we're making a diagnosis of glaucoma is looking for corroborating bits of evidence. Do we see signs of the optic nerve that fit in with the OCT that are consistent? Are there any changes in the visual fields? Are there other additional risk factors? Thinking about that image quality, is there anything else that could cause the issue with this OCT? That can make a huge difference if you've not got a good clear image, and sometimes dilating patients and getting a better image can be the difference between a normal scan and an abnormal looking scan. I think that there's a lot of anxiety about missing pathology that's there on your record on an OCT. And I think that we have to recognise the fact that I don't think that we can always be held accountable for being able to pick up everything on every single OCT scan. And it's important to try and avoid that aspect of anxiety. And it's okay to put in the referral, I'm really not too sure if I need to be referring this patient or not. Acknowledging that uncertainty and asking for feedback is a really useful way to be able to get some helpful feedback back on your referral. I know that it doesn't always work, but I think that sometimes you've probably got to be just that little bit more explicit in terms of asking what you want with that feedback for you to be able to continue to improve and develop. But there's some amazing OCT courses out there.
Yes. And of course, the instrument providers, you know, the manufacturers, quite often they are quite keen to train optometrists as well. So they have training and development programs themselves, don't they? So I think sometimes a good place to start is also the manufacturer of the actual OCT that you have.
Absolutely. Some of the guys involved in the development of OCT imaging, the depth of their knowledge and experience far outweighs that of many optometrists, I'm sure, when it comes to OCT imaging. And so making the most of that fantastic resource, and often free resource, is definitely worthwhile.
I guess the main thing to remember is don't base your clinical decisions on OCT alone. Look for the other glaucoma indicators and take into consideration all of the evidence before deciding whether or not to refer.
Absolutely.
Paddy, thank you very much again.
Well, thanks for having me, Michelle. It's been a pleasure.
Be sure to check out Paddy's webinar if you haven't watched it already by clicking on the link in the show notes. Also, if you head to docket.info and search for sound optometry, you can find additional reading materials and resources for this episode. By listening to the podcast and completing the short exercise on the website, you can gain one CPD point covering clinical practice and communication. We'll be back again next month. Until then, we'd really appreciate it if you spread the word about the podcast. Tell your colleagues to listen and subscribe to the series on your podcast app so you don't miss an episode. The producer is Jason Hoskin. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.